You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, with more people being at home and online, there have been some concerns about slowdowns and internet performance. We'll talk to a technology reporter about the internet's capacity to support the stay-at-home surge. Now, payment status not available. That's a line some or many of you may have seen when trying to trace your coronavirus recovery stimulus check on the IRS website. Some Americans have received payments from the government. Some haven't. Some people have even gotten payments for their deceased loved ones. There's so many questions around this rollout of stimulus money. We decided to check in with someone who's been covering the story quite a bit. Sahil Kapoor has been writing about the stimulus money as national political reporter for NBC News. Sahil, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, let's first talk about timing. Some Americans have gotten this up to $1,200 payout, and maybe more if you have kids, from the government. Some have not. What is distinguishing who's in that category and who's in the other one?
The single biggest thing in terms of the speed of this money being sent out is whether the eligible Americans have a direct deposit uploaded with the IRS so they can send it directly to their bank account. And if they don't, they have to send it by paper checks. Now, direct deposit is much faster. The IRS said last week it sent money directly into the bank accounts of about 80 million people. And a lot of others who don't have their bank information uploaded to the IRS have to wait for paper checks. And that's a process that could take weeks and in some cases even months.
And there's a IRS website where people can go and A, see if they're eligible, and B, if they haven't gotten their money yet and they are eligible, what's going on. That ran into some snags last week. Can you talk about that?
It certainly did. As you can imagine, shortly after the IRS started distributing that website, after it published it, there was an enormous amount of interest because literally tens of millions of Americans are eligible for these, and many of them are desperate. They need this money, this up to $1,200. To pay their rent, pay their mortgage, put food on the table. And many of them were checking the IRS website. Now, it did work for some of them. It's important to know that, you know, millions of Americans, according to the IRS, were able to get their status. I've heard from several of them that were able to find out what their status was, and some of them have gotten their money. But, of course, for a lot of people, it didn't work. Some of them seem to be getting false negatives, and the IRS was saying they have no information on their payment status, kind of suggesting that maybe they wouldn't be getting their money. But a lot of those people are still eligible and should be getting their money. So it seems to be a natural hazard of, you know, an agency that's kind of understaffed for the enormity of this moment.
And I should say, I just checked out the website earlier today, and it does. I didn't go all the way through the process, but you can at least get into the process now. It seems like they've at least overcome some of that initial crowd and surge of traffic.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's dwindled a little bit compared to last week when the early surge was pretty enormous. And the IRS is also encouraging people to post their bank account information, their direct deposits, so they can get the money faster. It's just it's a much more efficient and speedier way than you know, sending paper checks to all sorts of people. And I think there's still time to do that.
Talking to Sahil Kapoor from NBC News about the individual payments coming out of the CARES Act from Congress and the timeline for people getting this money. Many people, as we heard, have some still waiting, some able to go on a website, as Sahil just mentioned, put in direct deposit info and get that faster than waiting for a paper check. You mentioned, Sahil, a couple times people who are eligible, and it's important to note there are some people who are not. Can you talk about who is in that category, who does not get these payments?
So broadly speaking, you have to have an income of under $198,000 if you're a married couple filing jointly, or $99,000 if you're an individual. The payments go up to $1,200. They don't always get to $1,200 for everyone. You get an additional $500 per person. There are many categories of people that are excluded. If you're an undocumented immigrant, for instance, if you're here without proper legal status, you are not eligible. You know, if you're a college student and you're, say, 20 years old and you are claimed by your parents as a dependent, you are not eligible for that. So there are various categories of people who have sort of fallen through the cracks. And another one is disabled people who have parents that support them. You know, if you're a parent and you name someone as a dependent on your tax return, that person who is a dependent is not eligible for their own stimulus money.
Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Fitchburg. John, hello.
Hello. My question is, for a person who didn't have enough income to that required them to file an income tax return, how can they apply for that?
John, thanks a lot for the call. And Sahil, I know that's a question many people have, people on Social Security or people with limited incomes, whether or not they're eligible and if they have to do take extra steps if they are.
So this is an extremely important question, which is, I'll answer this in two ways. Firstly, if you're on Social Security, you don't need to do anything. If you're listening to this and you're on Social Security, the government has your information. You'd be getting an SSA 1099. Even if you're on SSI, Supplemental Security Income, you don't need to do anything. The government has your information and the checks will go out automatically. Now, for other categories of people who are not on Social Security and don't make enough to be required to file tax returns, what the IRS has done is release what they're calling a simple tax return. Basically, a form where you can fill out basic information like your filing status, your income level, whether or not, you know, whether you're single or married, that sort of thing. And it will, you know, the IRS will feed that information into the system. And if you're eligible, you should be getting money on that basis. So definitely check out IRS.gov and find that section where they'll allow you to input your information.
Thanks a lot for sharing that great question. A lot of people wondering about that. Sahil, you also reported on people receiving money for family members or loved ones who had passed away. Why is that happening? Are they going to be on the hook to give it back?
This is an unintended consequence of this policy. A lot of people who filed tax returns in 2019 or 2018 have since died, and the IRS has their information on file, and they are sending these checks automatically to people who filed tax returns in those years. As you can imagine, many of them have died, and their loved ones, you know, whether it's a spouse, whether it is an heir who is handling their estate, has received money on this person's behalf. Now, one source who is familiar with what the government plans to do here tells me that the loved ones are probably going to get to keep that money. So if you have a deceased relative and that money came to you, if you're a spouse of someone who recently died, if you're a family member, an heir of someone who recently died, you will probably get to keep that money, because this is kind of a consequence of the government deciding we're going to send these checks out as fast as we can. And that means that the error rate tends to be higher. You know, they could have done this slower. They could have tried to weed these people out. But that means a lot of other people who were eligible for this money would have had to wait. So the consequence is you have a lot of money being sent to dead people.
And the CARES Act didn't have a specific provision to prevent this or to claw back that money, as I understand it, Sahil. And I imagine there's not going to be a huge push in Congress to say, let's take money back from widows and widowers.
That is correct. The aides on Capitol Hill who were active in writing this legislation that I've talked to say that there probably isn't going to be any effort in Congress to demand that that money comes back. It's frankly very difficult to claw that money back. The way to ascertain it means, as you mentioned, you know, taking money away from widows and widowers. But how do you ensure that the money comes back? You end up having to audit closed estates. You end up having to audit the heirs of those people. And for what? For a grand total of $1,200 a piece. So it just may be more effort than it's worth for the government.
And you also wrote, I think, that people are having some confusion if they happen to be receiving their normal tax refund first or this payment first and not knowing which one it is.
Correct. So one thing I noticed is that the people who are getting direct deposit, some of them wrote to me and said the direct deposit information was coded exactly the same as their tax refund. So the stimulus payments and their tax refunds say the word tax REF in their bank statement. So a lot of them thought that one was the other. You know, so for people who are expecting a much bigger tax refund and saw the stimulus money, they were worried that maybe they got, you know, a lower tax refund than they were owed. In some cases, it's vice versa. People not getting much of a tax refund, but expecting $1,200 in stimulus payments, worried that one was the other. So there's definitely some of that happening.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Sahil, is there talk of another round of payments like this possibly in Congress?
There is talk among a group of Democratic legislatures, the House Progressive Caucus, held a conference call with, I guess a virtual press conference, you could say, with reporters and a number of members on the call, including Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, were demanding recurring payments. They say these $1,200 one-time payments are not going to be nearly enough for the scale of the crisis.
Sahil, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for NBC News. We talked to him today to understand more about what's happening with coronavirus recovery stimulus checks. Coming up, astronomers have spotted the brightest known supernova in a galaxy far away. We'll talk to an expert about the discovery and what it could mean for our knowledge of the stars. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the discovery of the brightest supernova on record. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a Why Wisconsin story that answers a listener's question about scientific research.
In the last decade, scientists have made incredible strides in understanding the world around us. From taking the first image of a black hole to unearthing new fossils that better map the human family tree, these discoveries are often awe-inspiring. In our next installment of Why Wisconsin, WPR's Jenny Peek heads to the lab to get a closer look at one of those discoveries, the gene editing tool CRISPR.
On a recent afternoon in the Saha lab, PhD candidate Nicole Piscopo put a petri dish of cells underneath a high-powered microscope. The cells, which were gene edited to include a gene from sea anemones, were glowing red.
So these cells are human melanoma, and then the part of them that glows red is the nucleus. These are a human cancer line that have been gene edited to fluoresce red.
Engineering these cells to light up enables Piscopo to more easily count the number of cancer cells that are present in her samples. Like this experiment, the Saha Lab at UW-Madison is at the forefront of engineering cell and gene therapies using CRISPR, a powerful tool for editing genomes. It lets researchers alter stretches of DNA and modify gene function. It's a big deal, lab lead Chris Saha says.
I think it's the most exciting development in bioengineering over the last decade.
But what exactly does CRISPR do?
CRISPR is a tool to change the letters of DNA that encodes the genetics of every cell in your body.
With the power to edit genes, CRISPR can be used to understand and treat genetic diseases, correcting mutations that cause ailments.
One example of a misspelling is a single change of a letter in the DNA that leads to sickle cell disease. One of the thoughts behind a therapy for sickle cell disease is to be able to change that single letter in the genome to a healthy version of that letter.
Okay, so CRISPR is a really powerful tool, but what is it made out of?
It's just protein and it's just nucleic acids, specifically RNA.
According to Saha, that concoction is able to go into a gene and change whatever is wrong with it, in theory, editing it to become healthy. This exploration of CRISPR was sparked by a question Wisconsin received from Jack Sims of Madison. After hearing a story about the technology and recognizing its potential, he wanted to know if any CRISPR or gene editing research was taking place at UW. In came Saha and his lab, who walked us through the science as well as how UW-Madison is pushing the envelope in the world of gene editing. One specific thing the Saha lab is using CRISPR for is to engineer new types of cells to fight cancer.
So there are now two T-cell therapies, immunotherapies for cancer that have been approved by the FDA. We are looking to try adding additional layers of genomic edits using CRISPR. There's just a lot of really exciting potential there in reprogramming and rewiring your immune system to better sense and kill cancer.
And CRISPR can be used in way more than just humans, Saha explains. From breeding a more drought-resistant crop to genetically engineering a mosquito capable of wiping out infectious diseases such as malaria, the possibilities seem endless, and UW-Madison is at the cutting edge. Saha says since he arrived at UW-Madison 7 years ago, CRISPR research has gone from its infancy to being a core part of science curriculum across the university.
It is being adopted and taught such that the next generation of practitioners learn from my mistakes and our mistakes, but also have the opportunity to make it even more precise and more powerful.
This story by Jenny Peek came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, a star blew up real good. And in February 2016 here on Earth, scientists observed something remarkable, a bright explosion in the sky. The bright light came from a small galaxy some 4.6 billion light years from Earth. It's thought to be the brightest supernova ever recorded. The stellar object known as SN 2016 APS was about 500 times brighter than other supernovae observed in the past. Our next guest joins us to talk about the discovery and what it tells us about the universe. Gene Creighton is an astronomer and director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Gene, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Gene, hit us with some supernova 101. What makes a supernova happen?
Okay, so let's start from what a supernova is. That would be the explosion of a massive star at the end of its life. And when I say massive, I'm talking at least 8 times heavier than the sun. The normal course of action is that a star like that is going to run out of, we'll call it nuclear fuel, so things that can fuse together and make a heavier element and release energy. So it runs out of that, and the star contracts because gravity wins. There's a battle between the inner pressure of the star and gravity, and if the fuel just doesn't deliver, then gravity can make the star collapse, and you form a neutron star. You basically take the mass of the sun and squeeze it down to the size of a city. That makes a pretty exotic leftover. The outer layers of the star bounce off that hard core we call usually a neutron star, and the whole thing explodes. This is a typical supernova. But the one that we saw just now is a superluminous supernova. So that's hundreds of times brighter than your typical supernova because the supernova goes off in stages and it makes shells of material around it. So you're slamming in the second kind of shell, slams into an already existing wall of material, but because that material is coming at it, I calculated this in miles per hour, 13 million miles per hour.
Wow.
It creates a tremendous amount of energy. So this is going to spark the whole thing up in a way that will be visible, as you say, 4 billion light years away. Now, it's worse than that. It's even more than that because the current one is twice as energetic as the next record holder, which means that now we need to come up with another, like you can't make that kind of energy with the usual mechanisms for a supernova. So we have two possibilities. I'll start with what I would consider the more prosaic, and I'll go to the more exciting one. If it turns out that the mass of this star, that what we call the progenitor, the thing that became the supernova, was about 100 times heavier than the sun. These are really, really massive stars. Then the neutron star it left behind, that was its core, would have been an even more extreme neutron star. We call these magnetars. And these magnetars have such strong magnetic fields that they are 100 million times stronger than any magnet that we've ever made on Earth in any lab and anything like that. So, many, many billions of times stronger than your typical MRI magnet. So that mechanism of a very strong magnetic field actually makes it hard because this is going to rotate, and it translates some of its rotational energy into radiation, which could be a mechanism to power the supernova. But the one that's exciting even more to me anyway is the possibility that this is what we call a pair instability situation. So let me tell you how this works. Now this you have to kind of hold your pants because this is really cool.
Pants held.
Okay. So we have a core of a star that gets so hot, like almost the early universe hot, that it starts converting radiation, light basically, into matter and antimatter, what we would call electrons and positrons. Now, sometimes when you say the word antimatter to people, they go immediately to thinking in terms of science fiction, but it's real. We know. We can see this in labs. We can get matter and antimatter from very strong light, from very strong radiation. Well, the thing is that if you convert that radiation into electrons and positrons, that doesn't help the battle between that pressure and gravity. So gravity wins and the core collapses. This is a runaway problem because as it gets, as the core collapses, it gets hotter, which means that I'm able to even make more electrons and positrons. So we basically have a runaway effect. What causes the event makes it even more so. So you have a thermonuclear explosion that destroys the entire star. Nothing is left. Most supernova leave behind something like a neutron star or black hole. This completely blows up and leaves nothing behind.
Well, we'll have to leave the story there for now and watch for astronomers in the future. Thanks to our guest, Jeanne Creighton, astronomer and director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at the UW-Milwaukee. She joined us today to talk about the discovery of the brightest known supernova that we've seen or measured here on Earth and what it could mean for astronomy. Coming up, we talk to a technology reporter about how the Internet is handling all the people working, gaming, and learning at home. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent and her guests share some great reading suggestions, and you can join in with your recommendations. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, while it's tough to know when places will peak in the number of coronavirus cases, we also don't know when we'll reach a peak in surging internet use related to people following stay-at-home orders. Video calls have become the norm for a lot of people for keeping up with work, family, and friends, and streaming television and movies remains a popular way to entertain, unwind, and escape. So how is the internet handling this increase in usage? Clint Finley is a technology writer for Wired. Clint, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, a month or so ago, you wrote a piece titled, Go Ahead, Stream All You Want, The Internet is Fine for Now. What's been happening since then? How are the internet tubes holding up?
Well, the average speed in the U.S. has dropped a little bit since that article was published. And in that article, I wrote about how speeds had dropped in recent weeks at that time. So they've continued to drop, though actually for the week ending April 6th, they ticked back up slightly. So the good news is speeds are haven't seen a massive drop quite yet.
Do we know, are there particular types of demand that might be slowing down speeds? Is that we're watching more, we're binging more TV at home, or we're doing our meetings or personal meetups online on video chat? What is putting the most strain on?
It does seem to be streaming video in the evenings that's putting the biggest strain. The daytime use of video conferencing and things like that hasn't been as big of a problem because the networks are already designed to handle a lot of video in the evening. And so just moving some of that traffic to the daytime hasn't had a massive impact. But at night, people are, you know, more people are at home streaming, more people are at home doing video calls. So the vast majority of the increase is coming from video.
You've reported that some services have lowered video quality, at least in some places or regions, to help make sure things don't get gummed up. What kind of changes have we seen over the last month and a half or so?
Not much has changed since then, I don't think. You know, Netflix, Amazon, YouTube, all of them decided to basically just cut back the default video quality for their services in Europe. And I think in some parts of the U.S., but not everywhere.
Clint Finley is with us, technology writer for Wired, looking at how the internet is holding up in a time of heavy demand, especially from home users. For the most part, the answer is pretty well. Clint, you mentioned the average speed earlier, and we know here in Wisconsin, there are places that are wired up pretty well, and then a lot of places in rural areas or even just outside of small towns or cities that don't have that kind of high-speed access. What are you watching for when it comes to how that plays out, the difference in access that people might have?
Well, and that's that also raises another point, which is that cities that have been more affected by COVID-19 are going to see worse congestion than cities that haven't been as affected, likely. But yeah, it's definitely opportunity of access is absolutely a huge issue that I'm watching.
Yeah, I think you wrote specifically about as students come home and try to learn from home, that being this could be a roadblock for a lot of people with lower access. What kind of things are we seeing in these still early days of at-home learning for so many kids?
Yeah, schools are having to find ways to essentially send home, like physical packets home to students, or sometimes DVDs with lectures on them to students who can't stream them at home.
Are there thoughts about, this is going to get worse, the internet demand, or have we seen peak usage and we're just kind of settling into where we're going to be for a while? What are people watching for there?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Like I mentioned, for the week ending April 6th, the speeds actually ticked back up slightly. And so far, the speeds amazingly haven't actually dropped below where they were for the week of December 23rd. So around the holiday season, another time that a lot of people were at home and streaming a lot of video and likely doing a lot of video calling, the networks have actually managed to maintain the same the same or better quality or speed as they did during that period. So that gives some hope that the networks were already pretty much ready for a lot of people to be at home and using them. But as this drags on, and more people are start to shift towards video as schools start closing for the entire year and putting more demands on students to stream video at home, and we might start to see a change there. Network operators, internet providers that tell me that they're doing, all the strategic upgrades that they can, in some cases doing updates that they had planned on doing a year from now, they're doing now to try to cope with all that demand.
You also wrote, Clint, about another possible choke point. Even if your internet is coming just fine, if all of a sudden you have a parent or two working online from home, a student or three doing their schoolwork online at home, their service in their house, their wireless in the house might be overwhelmed.
Right. That's one of the things we don't know about these. The speed averages, they come from Ookla, which does speed testing. They can't really tell if the slowdowns are coming from the networks or if they're coming from something else by the networks, I mean the internet service providers, or if they're coming from people's local networks, so their own Wi-Fi routers. So like you said, if a lot of people are all streaming on the same Wi-Fi router in the same home, if kids are streaming homework and then the parents are both on separate video calls, or some of the kids are watching television or over the internet, watching Netflix, then your local infrastructure, essentially your Wi-Fi router, can also start to bog down. So that's actually, if you're experiencing speed problems, that's something to check out.
We are talking to Clint Finley from Wired, and we are looking at the internet, personal in our house and out in the world too, and how it's dealing with a surge in demand as people work from home, conference from home, game from home more, and learn from home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. First of all, are you doing a lot online out of your home that you weren't previously? More distance meetings, distance learning, whatever it might be. Are you having trouble with speeds? Are you getting interruptions? Do you can your wireless router not keep up? You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can also share your experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Chris there, who says, my home sometimes has 3 simultaneous Zoom conferences during the day. It is definitely affected. Brandy tells us it's throttled at times, even though they say it's not. Don't like paying for speed. I don't get. Cassandra says she hasn't noticed a slowdown, but then my time on the computer is usually at the off times. You could join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about internet capacity during the coronavirus pandemic and stay-at-home orders. Wired technology reporter Clint Finley stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and experiences. Are you using the internets a lot more from home now? How many family members are doing stuff at the same time? Are you noticing slowdowns, or is it all working pretty smoothly? And it depends maybe on where you are in the state. Call 800-642-1234. Want to bring on now Scott Hoffman, CEO of Wynn Technology in Eau Claire. They lay fiber optics networks for internet service providers, cell phone companies, hospitals, and other businesses in the upper Midwest. They've been working to provide digital support to communities and businesses during the pandemic. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Great to be with you.
Well, from where you're sitting in the Eau Claire area, are you seeing a big surge there in internet use?
Yeah, we really are. You know, we've seen reports by wireless carriers overall that internet usage has increased 25 to 50%. Ourselves, we carry quite a bit of internet across our network. And since March 1st, that internet has increased significantly. Just to give you a sense, peak time for internet is usually in the evening, around 7 to 11 p.m., and we've seen internet usage at peak time grow around 30% during the day. Interestingly, the biggest growth has occurred where we've seen it grow 50% across our network since March 1st.
Interesting. Maybe during the workday. Now, are people having to do a lot of scrambling to make sure they have the bandwidth, the capacity to keep up with that demand?
Well, from our standpoint, we've seen this kind of growth on the internet year after year. So most carriers, providers like us, have planned for continued growth. So we made sure that we provision and build our network for that peak time in the evening and then plenty of spare capacity beyond that. So I think we've been like a lot of carriers where we've been able to absorb a lot of the extra usage within the last month. But if we've done anything, we've moved up our capital investment plans from third or fourth quarter to like the next couple months, where we're going to try to make sure we stay ahead of this.
And for the way customers are using things, we've seen things like where some providers are giving special deals or even free in some areas to students who are suddenly doing online learning. Are you seeing a lot of people, whether it's households, community groups, businesses, having it up their side of the equation when it comes to what they can handle?
Yeah, and I think the biggest driver for the change that's taking place, obviously, with the stay-at-home, safer at home, is the use of video across our network. I think that that's been the biggest challenge for end users. Hopefully, they have sufficient bandwidth across their network, and you know, maybe that takes the form of broadband into the home. But if they don't, hopefully, they've got access to a cell tower where they can obtain sufficient bandwidth.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's Scott Hoffman, CEO of the Eau Claire-based Wynn Technology, joining our conversation on how the internet is holding up with increased demand. Want to go back to Clint Finley now from Wired Magazine. Clint, do you think the case of what Scott was saying there, where a lot of these people who are laying cable were laying it with excess capacity in mind already, and that's maybe why we're not seeing massive slowdowns right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that every internet service provider I've talked to says, that when they lay capacity, they try to plan out for years in advance, far more than they expect to use anytime soon. Though, like I said, now they're starting to add capacity that they hadn't expected to need for another year on. Though a lot of the pipes themselves, that's usually not the issue. It's more issues in the data center with servers and routers and some of that type of equipment that where you'll find congestion.
I want to bring up an issue from a listener on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael brought up having a difficult time getting a cell phone call to dial out. I don't know if this is something you're following, Clint. Are there issues regarding cell towers? We've heard a big increase in demand for phone calls. Are we keeping up with that?
I haven't followed that closely at all. I should have, but there is the FCC has been allowing mobile providers to access more spectrum during the crisis. So that might be helping them keep up with some of this, though. I've also personally had a little bit of trouble with calls. Interestingly, though, for mobile internet, the speeds have actually been better for mobile in the U.S. than for fixed line connections like cable or DSL, especially when compared to other countries. So it could be that because people are home, they're not, using as much mobile data.
We also heard from Diane, who says she's very frustrated as we live in the country with only one choice of provider, two college students and one instructor, all trying to work/learn from home. Let's just say, Diane says, I am behind on any shows I had hoped to stream. Clint, do you see people hustling to try to get that last mile, those country services provided now? I know this has been a longer term problem in the country.
Yeah, it's something that that's been an issue for decades, and it's something that's only slowly being fixed. Some of the estimates I've seen show that it's a much bigger problem than the FCC has acknowledged, and that the cost of actually building out internet infrastructure to the entire country is going to be a lot more expensive than the government has budgeted thus far.
And Clint, in our last minute or so, what is the next technology angle you're watching during this coronavirus pandemic, and how it affects our daily lives and the technology industry?
Well, specifically regarding network connectivity, the thing that I'm watching and a little bit worried about is I've been talking about download speeds. Essentially, when I say speeds, but the other piece of that is upload speeds. For home internet, you usually have a much slower upload connection than download connection, and for the most part, usually that's fine because people are just mostly streaming video, but to watch things like Netflix. But with more video conferencing happening, that I worry that capacity is not enough to keep up with the demand, as people upload video of themselves essentially as part of a video call.
It's a story that'll keep going. Clint, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks a lot.
That's Clint Finley, technology writer for Wired. We talked to him today about the internet's infrastructure and how it handles a surge in usage during the current pandemic. You can keep sharing your thoughts. A lot of people, thank you to everybody who passed along questions and experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you have a story to share, good or bad, when it comes to how connected you are right now, you can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The The 2020 presidential election just might be decided in the suburbs. Heavily Republican suburban areas have moved toward the Democratic Party in recent elections. In western Wisconsin, Democrats in St. Croix County are hoping to capitalize on that trend in a May 12th special congressional election and again in November. WPR's Rob Mentzer has more.
From downtown Hudson, Wisconsin, there's a pedestrian bridge that crosses the St. Croix River and into Minnesota. On the interstate nearby, cars zip by on their way to the Twin Cities. Today, Hudson is basically an outer suburb of Minneapolis-St. Paul. Danielle Johnson says that wasn't always the case.
Growing up in this area, I grew up in Red Wing. I remember when Hudson was not part of urban sprawl. It was just a small town in Wisconsin.
Johnson is co-chairwoman of the St. Croix Democratic Party. She sees political tides changing here. Democrats are organizing in Hudson and in rural parts of the county, too. At a chili cook-off and candidate meetup in March, Johnson told the assembled Democrats that the party is focused on grassroots organizing.
But we're going to really reach out to all parts of St. Croix County and turn it blue. So.
One of the candidates who spoke there was Trisha Zunker. She's facing Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany in the 7th Congressional District. On the day before Governor Tony Evers declared COVID-19 a statewide public health emergency, Zunker made three campaign appearances in St. Croix County.
When we flip this seat, Wisconsin is blue again, and that has enormous implications for the 2020 presidential election.
Zunker says she's gotten a lot of support from the area.
There are people on the ground that are helping turn people out, that are helping get the word out, and they're posting on Facebook, they're using social media, they're making phone calls.
In the spring election, held amid the state's stay-home order, the conservative candidate for Supreme Court narrowly won in the 7th District, even as he lost the statewide race by 10 points. But in St. Croix County, the result was tantalizingly close for Democrats. The county that voted for Trump by more than 18 points in 2016 split nearly 50-50 in the Supreme Court race. Most of the 7th Congressional District is rural, which is one reason the special election is seen as an uphill climb for Democrats. But every Democrat in the region points to St. Croix's State Senator Patty Schachner as proof that they can win. Schachner won a surprise victory in her special election in the district in early 2018. Outside the chili cook-off, Schachner says the pitch for Zunker and Democrats is simple.
The big thing is, are you better off today than you were, 6 weeks ago, 6 months ago, 2 years ago? And if you weren't, Trisha Zunker is worth taking a chance on.
Opposition to the president fuels a lot of the Democrats' energy here.
Like many, many people, when Trump got elected, it was just a shock and devastation.
Tammy Mutaden is an occupational therapist in Hudson. With Johnson, she's co-chairwoman of the county Democrats. In 2016, she was doing home health care in rural Wisconsin.
I like to tell people I literally saw the signs because I saw lots of Trump signs, and it was really worrying me. And everybody was saying, oh, he's not going to win, he's not going to win. And I said, I'm not so sure about that.
Mutaden is 56. She says she's been a single mom on welfare, and she's seen the value of a strong social safety net. After Trump's election, she and her daughter went to the Women's March in Washington, D.C. It was the first time she had ever participated in a political protest.
When I came back, I thought, well, okay, what can I do next? What can I do now to make sure that wasn't just a one-off?
She joined the St. Croix Democrats. She served on the county board for 3 years, and she's working to elect Democrats this year. There are a lot of people like Mutaden in places like Hudson. In the Trump era, Republicans have lost support in suburban areas across the country. Trump's approval rating is still high in rural areas. It's still low in cities. It's in the suburbs where there's been the most change. Rob Benser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of WPR's special election coverage looking at who Wisconsin voters are and how they're changing. To read more, go to WPR.org/swingstate. Thank you to all who donated during our spring member drive to ensure the resources are in place. We fundraised throughout the year. It's all been affected at this time. So if you missed the drive, you can give now at WPR.org. If you're a sustainer, as always, thank you. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, people are turning to the media for coverage of the COVID-19 virus as media outlets face challenges of layoffs and other obstacles. A journalism expert looks at disease coverage today and how it compares to past outbreaks. We're living in an unusual time, and we can get a lot out of documenting our experience for ourselves and future generations. We'll get advice on why and how to keep a COVID-19 journal. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Kate and her guests get ready for flooding season in Wisconsin with a look at the risks facing different communities around the state. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then our guest says grocery store employees, home health workers, and other essential employees should get hazard pay during the COVID-19 pandemic. You can share your thoughts and maybe your experiences if you're one of those workers over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.